and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman. Taylor Bickford with the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol in Alaska, Lance Buchholz of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Ben Court of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, and former Chief Assistant Attorney General for Alaska, Dean Guinelli. Moderated by Jason Brandeis of the UAA Justice Center, titled Time to Legalize, a Public Discussion on Marijuana Law and Policy, was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on March 5th and shortened for broadcast on KSKA.
I'd like to take a few moments and introduce the panel. The first person I'd like to introduce is seated right next to Ethan. This is Taylor Bickford. Taylor works for the Alaska office of a national strategic communications firm, and he serves as an advisor and spokesperson for the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol in Alaska. Seated next to Taylor is Sheriff Lance Buchholz. And Lance, I don't know where to begin with your background. Lance is a retired law enforcement official. He is also a fifth generation farmer. He is an ordained minister and a beekeeper. Lance is here on behalf of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Seated next to Lance is Dean Guinelli. Dean is the former Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Section of the Alaska Department of Law. Dean had a very long and distinguished 30-year career as an attorney. He has since shifted gears, and he's now an artist. I know there are some lawyers in the room here tonight, and if you are practicing law in Alaska, you may have worked for Dean or worked with Dean or as the moderator for this panel has worked opposite Dean on several cases. But if you have encountered Dean in your professional career, you know that he is a very talented attorney and worked on a number of precedent-setting cases in Alaska and helped to draft very significant pieces of legislation. And we're very, very pleased that he was able to come up from Juneau to join us here tonight. Seated next to Dean is Ben Court. And I guess Ben is essentially the anti-Ethan here tonight, for lack of a better term. Ben is here on behalf of Project SAM. SAM stands for Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And Ben has a very interesting background. Ben has been part of the recovery community in almost every way imaginable, as a recipient, as a provider, and a spokesperson. He's on the board of directors of Project SAM, but he's also a junior fellow at the University of Florida's Drug Policy Institute. He serves on the board of directors for the Denver-based Stout Street Foundation, and he leads the business development team for CEDAR, which is a world-class treatment center for residential addiction and co-occurring disorders in Aurora, Colorado. And I thought that a good way to get the discussion started tonight would be to give Ben a little bit of time to respond to some of the questions or some of the points that Ethan raised. I saw him furiously taking notes. So Ben, why don't you take a few minutes and tell us a little bit about what Project SAM is doing, what SAM's view is on marijuana legalization, and otherwise respond to Ethan's comments.
I'll leave the description of what SAM is up to you guys. Go ahead and take a look at the website. It's learnaboutsam.org if you're interested. Basically, it's a science-informed national organization, international now, actually. We just launched a Canada branch that believes pretty firmly that science should be at the core of all of these policy decisions. We reject the false dichotomy that it's either lock them up or legalize it, and I think it's a little bit more thoughtful approach. It's why I joined them, because I think that this conversation far too often gets boiled down into quick little things that fit on a bumper sticker. And the reality is that this is complex, it's nuanced, it's interesting. It's a very fascinating conversation to be a part of. And I'll tell you guys how I got into it in a minute. But first of all, let me address the potential perception of somebody coming to your state to tell you about your ballot initiative. I'm from Colorado, and I actually quit my job, the nonprofit that I helped to start that got folks in recovery or trying to get into recovery, they got them outside and got them climbing and biking and camping and hiking and fishing, and it was great. It was fun. I loved it. I left when we had about 30 people working for us and about 10,000 people doing activities with us. It was all free, of course. It was a nonprofit. I left so that I could get involved on the formal No on 64 campaign, which was our constitutional amendment that legalized recreational marijuana. And when I started taking part in these debates, one of the things that really irked me was when the guys from out of town would come and tell me what I was supposed to do. And so I want to address that kind of head on with you guys and tell you, first off, that's not my intention. Your state has a very, very special spot in my heart. 2 years, I got sober in 1996, and 2 years after that, after driving for about 4 months, found my way up here and spent, almost 6 weeks driving around, hitchhiking around, and just absolutely fell in love with this place. I have seen, I don't think I'd ever really seen the beauty that America's got to offer till I spent the time I did in Alaska. This is a special place and somewhere where I really hope to end up one day. But so when people would come in and tell me what I needed to know, I felt like it was always a little bit their perspective, my state, my consequences kind of thing. So I'm not here to tell you what I think that you guys should do at all. I'm here to tell you what happened in Colorado and what is happening in Colorado. Stop. You guys know the old adage that a smart man learns from his mistakes and a wise man from the mistakes of others. This is no longer theoretical. This is no longer a what if. This has happened in Colorado. This will happen in Washington soon. So we now get to be the test case. You know, people continually refer to us as an experiment. And boy, whether it's the president or the news anchor or the whatever it is, it always gets my blood boiling a little bit, because the fact of the matter is that you don't experiment on people who didn't sign up to be experimented on. You don't experiment on kids. You don't experiment on a mass group of folks who don't have any say in what they're being poked and prodded with. I'm the father of three kids in public school in Colorado. I resent the idea that our state is being used as this massive experiment. But if it must be, then let me tell you guys what's going on. And we're going to get to that. I think we've got plenty of time for it. What's happening in Colorado is not what we signed up for. The quick sound bite, the short little legalize it, go, go, rah, rah, tax, regulate, like alcohol. That's not what happened. What happened, and what I urge you guys to do, and one of the reasons why I love this place so much is the, you guys are thinkers, and what I urge you guys to do here is to really question some of the short taglines that you hear around this. This is a complex problem, and you are not simply legalizing a substance. We can talk all day about how incredibly flexible the laws are here in Alaska and how basically the only thing that you can't do is sell marijuana back and forth and drive it around. You can grow it and you can consume it so long as you're in your house. From what I understand, Dean can tell us more about that later. What this is this is the industrialization of marijuana. That is what's happened in Colorado, and that is what the goal of this is here in Alaska. It's not about letting you guys get high. Get high. I don't care if you get high. Listen, I'm a recovering drug addict. So far as I know, I'm the only recovering drug addict who's here. I'm the last person who's going to start casting stones. Go. Fine. Don't drive. Don't let my kids see. I don't care. Not about demonizing a substance. Absolutely not. Not about defending laws that don't make sense. Absolutely not. I'm here to tell you that this legislation, read it. Read it in its entirety, specifically protecting it. Well, you need 8 pages to get all of this done, because it's about protecting those commercial interests. This is a big, giant sign. Welcome to Alaska. Industrialized marijuana, big marijuana, whatever in the world you want to call it. This has happened in Colorado. We've got two companies that say they'll be doing $1 billion in commerce inside of Colorado this year, Open Vape and Dixie Elixirs. That's not little you and me fighting the man sort of stuff. That's the big business. That's the big power. And to address what I'm sure is going to come up really quickly, the rehab program that I work for, because I can't get away from it, I love it too much, it's my heart. I got to be with the folks who are at that place where they need the help. It's a nonprofit. It's a hospital-based. And not only would we never accept anyone who was forced into treatment, I am absolutely philosophically opposed to the idea of forcing anyone into treatment. What I believe in is making sure that we create and maintain a society that does not overly, that doesn't allow drugs to become, marijuana to become totally normalized to a younger generation, then lead to further issues that come along with that. So tonight I'm going to talk specifically about the law that you guys are facing in Alaska. I've read it, read it, understand it, and know it's not legalization. This is an effort at industrialization of marijuana in your home state, like they did in mine.
Thank you, Ben. Before I kick some of those points that you raised to the other panelists, I wanted to give Dean an opportunity to take off his ceramicist hat and put his lawyer hat, sorry, Dean, put his lawyer hat back on for a moment and tell, maybe just explain for those of you that are unfamiliar with some of the lingo, when we talk about legalization, what does that mean? What is the difference between legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing marijuana? And Dean, to the extent you can briefly address this, if you could sort of summarize maybe Alaska's unique marijuana privacy laws, I think that would, the audience would be appreciative of that background.
Well, thanks, Jason, for that task. As Ben says, it's not an easy subject, and in Alaska, it hasn't been easy for many, many years. But to answer the first question, a crime is simply something that legislature, society has declared that society condemns, and condemns in such a way that you could go to jail for doing it. When you decriminalize something, it means that conduct no longer is a crime. It's no longer something you can go to jail for. Now you can decriminalize it to the point where there's no penalty associated with it, or you can decriminalize it to the point where you can't go to jail for it, you can just be fined. And in this, in the initiative, the part about public display using marijuana in public is decriminalized because it would no longer be a crime, but it isn't made completely legal because you can still be fined for doing that. And so these little nuances are important to lawyers. I don't know how much of this really is all that relevant to the main points that I think we want to discuss in any policy discussion. I think that if you look at the initiative, what Ben Court says about it is accurate. It is decriminalizing and actually making completely legal the retail selling of marijuana and the commercialization of marijuana. That's what this does. That's the main point of this. It would regulate it, trying to regulate it like alcohol. In my view, we don't do a terribly good job dealing with alcohol. But there's certainly one aspect of the initiative that I think is is an important thing to take into consideration, and that's, and we can talk about it later if someone wants to ask me about it, but its effect on rural Alaska, on Native Alaskans, and allowing marijuana to get into the rural villages more than it does right now. So that's my thumbnail sketch of decriminalization and legalization.
Thank you, Dean. Well, we've got a lot of questions that have come in from the audience, and we're going to try to get to all of them tonight. Before there are some very specific questions about the Alaska initiative. There are some questions about what's happening in Washington and Colorado, what the results and the social consequences of legalization has been so far in those states. But before I get into your questions, I just want to ask Taylor to comment on a point that Ben brought up. And Ben, this is what stood out to me in the comment that you made, and that is the fear of industrialized marijuana, or as I've read, as Ethan has described it, the Marlboroization of marijuana, or the big marijuana industry. And Taylor, maybe you can speak to Ben's criticism of the initiative as being something that is just favoring the industrialization of marijuana.
Sure. Thank you, Jason. First off, I just want to say I really appreciate the opportunity to be here for the campaign, to have a presence on the panel. And I appreciate the opportunity to be involved in such an important issue in this state. I grew up in Alaska. I was born here. I went to high school in Alaska. I was married here. My wife and I have decided to raise our 3-month-old daughter here. And I've spent most of my life here, about 80% of it. And part of what I love about this state is the spirit that the state was built on. It's a spirit of individualism, a spirit of liberty and personal responsibility. And those are principles that very much cut to the core of the marijuana issue. And I think it looks to me like most people in this room recognize that we sort of lost sight of those principles when it comes to this issue. So I think clearly there seems to be from Mr. Guinali and Mr. Quart some sort of demonization of free enterprise, economic development, and the idea that an industry, $2 billion industry being set up in the state is somehow a bad thing. I would disagree very strongly with that. What we know is happening now is that marijuana is here. People are using it. We saw all the hands that were raised when Ethan asked who's used it, who knows someone who's used it. And so that industry is already here. That money is already being spent. The difference is the money is being spent on the black market, and the money is entirely benefiting criminal organizations and is not being taxed by the state and is not benefiting the state in any way. It's benefiting criminals, drug dealers, et cetera. And so I don't buy the argument that passing this initiative will create the industry, because the industry is already here. And what we're talking about doing is bringing it out of the underground and bringing it and regulating it in such a way that Alaskans can actually benefit from the commerce that's already taking place.
Thank you, Taylor. One of the questions that keeps coming up in the responses that we're seeing here tonight, and I know something that's a big part of this debate, is the impact that marijuana legalization will have on people driving under the influence of marijuana. And I want to maybe first address this question to Lance and to ask if you have any, as a former law enforcement official, if you have any thoughts or comments about people driving while stoned and what impact legalization will have on the rates or incidence of people driving after smoking marijuana.
Sure. Well, obviously, I'm not going to sit here and condone anyone operating a motor vehicle while under the influence of any kind of intoxicant. I can only speak for Wisconsin law. I'm not trying to be some outsider who's, coming up here and telling you what to do. Even though you don't have the office of sheriff in Alaska, I understand and appreciate that, which, much to Ethan's chagrin, makes me a big celebrity up here. If you want my autograph later, I'd be more than happy to stay. I did bring my horse and six-shooter, and I do have a Stetson in the back room. As far as operating while intoxicated in Wisconsin, it's probably a little bit different, and I know it's different in Alaska from talking to some officers up here, and that you have a different way you handle that. In Wisconsin, intoxicated is defined as operating with any intoxicated, that's a wrong term to use next to a couple attorneys. It's any substance in your blood that would impair your ability to operate the motor vehicle. So we can, in Wisconsin, arrest you for operating while intoxicated. It does not have to be alcohol. It can be any substance like that. We do a blood screen, and if you have any marijuana in your system, you're going to get convicted of the operating while intoxicated. But we do a blood screen for, I believe we're up to 24 different substances right now. And when I say Wisconsin's a little different is you do have a right of refusal for the test, for the blood draw. You go ahead and refuse, and that is then another charge. You get charged with a second offense, and guess what? We take the blood anyway. So when you're out there writing the ticket, you know, here's your ticket for OWI, you know, are you going to take the test or not? And they say, I don't think I'm going to take the test. And you'll be sitting there going, take the test, take the test. And everyone who comes in the room says, take the test. So it's a separate charge in Wisconsin. Right.
Lance, can I just ask, does LEAP have an official a position or a best practices or a suggestion for law enforcement personnel in how they might deal with a potential increase in people driving under the influence of marijuana?
Well, I'm not so sure that you would see an increase. And I would just say that officers should just do their job. They're sworn to do a job. You take an oath of office. You need to get people out. If you have probable cause to make a stop, and it's a reasonable stop, make it. See what the offense is. I mean, I've stopped people for what I thought was OWI on several occasions, and it turns out to be a medical issue. It turns out to be someone who worked a 20-hour shift. I mean, some ridiculously long shift, and they're just exhausted. They aren't intoxicated. But you need that discretion as an officer. One of the things I'm concerned with and what brought me to LEAP was the militarization of law enforcement. Instead of being community caretakers, when you have a drug war, you have to have warriors. And people are afraid to approach their local police nowadays. It seems, you know, they've become almost like an occupying army in their own communities. I think we need to draw the line here and get back to community policing, community-oriented policing.
Well, that certainly raises some other issues that I hope we can get to a little bit later. Ben, is there any data or any information coming out of Colorado that can give us some insight into whether we're seeing increases in people driving under the influence of marijuana?
Yeah, I wish I had the numbers for Washington at my fingertips. I don't. I know Sam just did a press release with it, though, because they were so much higher. So Colorado, in January alone, we had 60 arrests for drug driving. And keeping in mind that the cops in Colorado have a real hard time arresting you for a drug driving. They would much rather have it be another offense. If there's any alcohol, they're of course going to go that route because of how difficult it is to test and because of the inconsistencies with the way that you can test. We have a per se legal limit in Colorado. Very frankly, some people might meet that per se legal limit and be full on sober, and some people might be below it and be full on stoned. It's not easy. It's not a quick breathalyzer where 0.08 is drunk, and we know that. So 60 in January is the number that we have that was just released. I think that's compared to 15 at this time last year. So we are seeing a marked increase in at least arrests for drugged driving. How many more are actually going on out there? I'm not sure.
Ethan, do you have any thoughts? Does DPA have any thoughts on whether or not legalization is going to lead to a significant increase in drugged driving, such as that should weigh against legalizing marijuana?
It's impossible to say. I mean, I don't see any strong evidence or reason to believe it will lead to that. I think as we have greater awareness and understanding about marijuana, its impact on driving, and the ways in which it's impacted by use with other drugs. So there are now dozens of studies on marijuana and driving from around the world. And what do we basically find? We find, first of all, that if you're an inexperienced marijuana user and you get high, don't drive, right? If you are an experienced marijuana user, but all of a sudden you smoke some stuff that's not the stuff you're used to, do not drive. If you're smoking marijuana, use marijuana, and you're combining it with alcohol or pharmaceutical drugs, benzos, you know, Valium-type drugs, things like that, very dangerous, right? The combination of alcohol and marijuana is a real problem. If you are an experienced marijuana user and you drive, it turns out, first of all, that people, when they drive under the influence of marijuana and they're an experienced marijuana user, they're not like drunk drivers. They don't tend to speed. They tend to get in trouble because they're driving too slowly, right? I mean, that's sort of more of the issue there. Maybe they forget a little bit where they were headed. But it's not that they're swerving lanes, right? The other thing you find is there are a number of studies, including some paid for by the U.S. government, where they looked at experienced marijuana users driving, and they were unable to find a distinction between the driving behavior of people, experienced marijuana users driving, and those who were totally straight, right? Which is not the truth. I mean, Ben's right. There are some people who can be over the 0.08 or whatever and still keep it straight. You learn how to adapt if you're a heavy drinker and you're driving. But by and large, alcohol has much more of a distorting impact. So my real concern is if you see more people who are driving under the influence of marijuana and alcohol. That's the real risk. To the extent there's some substitutability with marijuana, I think we're actually going to see a decline. And in fact, there's an interesting study that was published by the University of Chicago just last year, a guy named Daniel Reese, as I was just looking up on the phone, that actually showed that in the states that had legalized marijuana for medical purposes, you actually saw a decline in driving under the influence fatalities in those states. And they couldn't not prove there was a causal relationship between the legalization of medical marijuana and that, but it's interesting that in those states that changed the law to decriminalize or legalize, you saw a drop in fatalities on the road.
Interesting. Dean, let me put you on the spot again for a second. And in your work as a prosecutor in Alaska, you are obviously dealing with unique marijuana laws. And I'm just wondering if you came across any information or statistics about whether driving under the influence of marijuana in Alaska was higher than in other states, given the fact that adults in Alaska were allowed to use marijuana under limited circumstances.
The problem with marijuana and driving is that it's hard to test. Even with a blood test, I mean, there's as has been said, there's no breath test that will measure the amount of marijuana in your system. Even with a blood test, what you end up with is a result that people will say, "Oh gosh, I smoked 2 days ago. This, you know, I wasn't smoking currently." And we know that THC builds up in your fat cells, and that over a period of time, it comes out gradually. And so you're going to have some. If you've smoked recently, you're going to have some amount of marijuana in your blood anyway. So testing for these things is really very difficult. There have been other studies that have shown that accidents increase. There's a five-fold increase in accidents with people who test positive for marijuana. Does that mean that they were driving under the influence of marijuana, or that the marijuana, they had used it a couple days before or recently enough that they still had some effect? I don't know. It's just too difficult to say. But I guess the question is, why take the risk? I mean, there's so many problems with marijuana, the amount of dependency, its effect on alcohol treatment, making alcohol treatment more difficult, making mental health treatment more difficult, people having psychotic breaks occur much more frequently. There are so many risks with marijuana, and that's just talking about adults. We haven't even talked about kids. Why take the risk? I mean, what is there to be gained in taking the risk? Taylor talked about taxing. Sure, we can tax it a little bit. Colorado's on slate to get maybe $100 million in tax revenue this year. But they've got seven times the population. Alaska might get $15 million. What can we do with that? I mean, Ethan talks about, you know, building new schools and improving the education system. What, going to build a couple of classrooms with that amount of money? I mean, the problem that we have is not going to be solved by $15 million extra. What we're going to get is more dependency, more problems with alcohol treatment, more problems with our mental health system. And again, there's wherever marijuana has been made legal or decriminalized, call it whatever you want, even where medical marijuana has been allowed in states, the rate at which young people use it increases. I'm not willing to go down the road that, you know, that Ethan wants us to go down, that the kids are always going to get it. They may be able to get it when it's legal, when it's out there, when more of it is out there, when there are commercial interests, advertising, making products that appeal to kids, they're going to use it a lot more. And so somebody asked me about the effect on kids.
Okay, so a lot of information in that answer. I'm going to do a couple of things. I know Taylor wanted to quickly respond when there was a comment about driving. So I know Taylor has a point he wants to make about that. Ethan's got a point that he wants to make about something. And what I want to do is allow you two to make those two comments quickly, and then we're going to have to take a 30-second break for some camera maintenance. Okay. And then after that, I would like to ask a couple of questions about a point that Dean just raised, and that is the effect of marijuana legalization on mental health concerns and on children. I know we've got some questions about that, and I know there are some people in the crowd that are very interested in those issues. So Taylor, do you want to respond to the driving?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that the driving under the influence of marijuana issue doesn't have a whole lot to do with the ballot initiative. That issue is going to exist regardless of whether or not this initiative passes in August. We know that Alaskans are using marijuana. They're using a lot of it. And you know, I'm going to steal a page out of Ethan's book here. Can you guys raise your hands and tell me if any of you remember the last time that you heard of a violent accident occurring from a marijuana user? How about an alcohol user? Okay, marijuana is in this state. It's being used every single day. And we're not seeing this... you know, the sky isn't falling. We're not seeing these horrific problems on the roadways. And I think that our law enforcement professionals are very good. And they, again, under prohibition, people are still using it, and it's not a problem. And we have no reason to believe that if prohibition is ended, that all of a sudden this problem is going to come out of thin air, because it's something that is not a problem today, and marijuana is being used in this state every day. I think it's important to recognize.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I was listening to Dean for the first minute, saying, that's very reasonable. Yeah, and then he just said two things, the first of which, that marijuana legalization will result in an increase in alcohol abuse, for which, as far as I know, there is no empirical evidence. And then he claimed that any state or any jurisdiction that has legalized or decriminalized marijuana has seen an increase in adolescent use. And in fact, that's flat out inaccurate. In fact, what you see is around the country, there are lots, some states where that's true, many places where that's not true. In fact, you actually had the government oversampling in states that legalized medical marijuana in the late 90s and not seeing any increase in adolescent use. In fact, it was lower than other states. Then you can look in the Netherlands, which effectively legalized the retail sale of marijuana in the late 70s, and it's at 30 years. And what do you see in the Netherlands? That use went up and down and up and down, more or less at the same rates it did in other European countries that did not decriminalize, right? The other thing you see is that rates of marijuana use in the Netherlands are much lower than they are in places like the United States or the United Kingdom, which have very tough marijuana laws. And then you see that the percentage of young people who try marijuana and go on to try harder drugs is lower in the Netherlands than in the US and other countries, in good part because the Dutch separated the market. They separated the soft drug, quote unquote, marijuana market from the other drug. So I just needed to correct, I mean, you're talking about putting information out there, but it's important that there be an empirical basis for this, that we acknowledge where there's conflicting evidence and don't make claims where those claims should not fairly be made.
Dean or Ben, would you like to respond to Ethan's comments?
What I said was that marijuana use makes alcohol treatment more difficult. Didn't say it increases alcohol abuse. It makes the treatment more difficult. The legislature, our legislature, held hearings in 2006 about marijuana and heard evidence from people in the treatment community in Alaska that use of marijuana by people who are alcoholics and in treatment makes their recovery from alcoholism much more difficult. That's going to happen more often. And the last thing we need in Alaska is something that makes alcohol treatment more difficult. That's what I said. The other thing I said was that with respect to those places that have decriminalized marijuana or even made medical marijuana available, is that it increases the rate at which young people use marijuana. And I'll stand by that.
No, well, you lose. You lose on that one. Sorry.
Okay. All right, well, why don't we take our
quick... I don't think you can come up with a study to show, actually, any real strong evidence that jurisdictions that have decriminalized marijuana make it harder for people who are addicted to alcohol to change their problems. I'd like to see that study that's emerged. I'd love to see the evidence.
There was testimony in front of the Alaska legislature.
I believe that you can get a person in a drug treatment program needing to say that. I'd love to see any sort of reliable, objective, scientific study actually supporting that kind of claim.
Okay, well, why don't we take a quick break and do our camera maintenance?
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman, Taylor Bickford with the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol in Alaska, Lance Buchholz of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Ben Court of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, and former Chief Assistant Attorney General for Alaska, Dean Guinelli, moderated by Jason Brandeis of the UAA Justice Center, titled Time to Legalize, a Public Discussion on Marijuana Law and Policy, was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on March 5th and shortened for broadcast on KSKA.
Okay, well, we just heard some comments about alcohol abuse, about treatment, about marijuana making it more difficult to deal with the problem of alcohol. And we have a number of questions up here that ask about the relationship between marijuana use and alcohol, about mental health treatment, and about the impact that marijuana legalization will have on adolescents. So Ben, maybe you could get us started with this and talk a little bit about what is happening in Colorado and what the arguments are or any information that you have about how marijuana legalization impacts mental health concerns.
Mental health and youth use? Or
why don't we'll just keep them separate for now and they'll come back and talk about adolescent later.
Cool. The adolescent's a really compelling story. I can't wait to tell you guys that one. The mental health, yes, there's some interesting stuff out there. Dr. Paula Riggs, who's on faculty with University of Colorado Hospital, has some real interesting studies. And again, I'm going to really encourage us, we are not speaking theoretically anymore. This is not about other countries. This is not about medicinal stuff in the 90s. Let us tell you what's going on in Colorado, because we are several months ahead of where you guys propose to be. So really look to us for where this is headed. I mean, that just makes rational sense. So there is an absolutely well-established link, particularly younger, and this is where the conversation gets a little bit, it's not a quick soundbite. So somebody who has a pre-existing mental health condition, their likelihood of having that condition worsened with marijuana use is very real. But it's not something that, so here's your perfect example. And I've heard people, me on this side of it, sometimes I fall in with a kind of old school crowd who wants me to gather in and demonize everything. And so I actually heard once, okay, you guys remember that guy in Florida last year who attacked the other guy and, I didn't want to, like, went after his face, right? So I had somebody send me an email and say, marijuana was the only substance they found in his body. Isn't that incredible? Marijuana made him do this. Okay, no. Really, more than likely, maybe, and this is probably, I haven't seen the guy's medical records, and if I did, I'm not a doctor, so I can't tell you just what it would be. But what happens is if you have a pre-existing condition, the likelihood that one of those psychotic episodes or psychotic breaks is going to happen to you increases about sixfold with chronic marijuana use. That increase is more significant the younger you start. So maybe a guy like this had a pre-existing mental health condition and something happened. Whether or not it was his drug use, I can't. Who can say that? So I think what we need to do is stay away from really intense and kind of demonizing things like that. Again, I've never actually seen Reefer Madness, but I've heard enough about it. The devil weed and the demon weed and this will make an army of zombies kind of thing. We need to stay away from that kind of thing, and we do actually need to recognize, again, look into some of this research. It's fascinating stuff. Dr. Paula Riggs, University of Colorado Hospital. There is a well-established link between chronic use and mental health issues, particularly psychotic episode to psychotic break. But again, that's much more likely the younger you start and the more frequently you use. How was that?
That's good. But let me ask you a quick follow-up question. So, I hear a lot in the points that you're taking and the positions you're making about treating, looking at addiction and recovery, and I hear those words and I hear medical issues and hear public health concerns. And, Sam is taking this position that there is a smarter, better way to address marijuana, and legalization is not the answer. So could you tell us a little bit about what Sam suggests? What is the approach? Do we just keep the status quo, or is there a plan in place that you advocate that will address some of these health concerns that are associated with marijuana use?
The treatment of addiction, Ethan and I are well aligned on this, that the treatment of addiction belongs squarely within the public health conversation. That's where it traditionally was. It's where it belongs now. What Sam advocates is pretty close to me personally. Let me tell you guys, as kind of the guy on the Sam board who they ask questions about addiction to a lot of the times, the non-doctor guy who they ask questions about treatment and recovery, I think it's really important that we do have the opportunity to intervene with people. I was a good example there. And had an arrest with a possession to intent. An arrest for possession and an arrest with possession with intent to distribute. Neither one of those interventions ultimately led to my getting the help that I needed because I wasn't at the place where I needed it yet. But I know lots of guys who did have that intervention and heard something or were told something or were put into a situation where something clicked for them. So again, I will never advocate putting people in jail for the possession of small amounts of marijuana. Not a good thing. I don't know many people who would advocate for that. What I do think we've got to maintain the ability to do is to have those brief interventions. In Colorado, they call it the ESPRT, the screening and brief intervention for treatment. And sometimes it's really good and sometimes it's not. The reality of it is that some people who present like they might have an issue might just be abusers, might not actually be addicted, or you might have just had a bad weekend. The differentiating between true addiction, abuse, and a rough weekend is an important thing. And let me be super clear here. Nobody inside of the business I work in, which is drug treatment, wants to treat people who don't want to be there or who don't belong there. There's a big difference between the addicted user, the recreational user, the whatever. The reality of what has happened and is happening here at home for me is that those rates have stayed the same for marijuana use. It's not some crazy thing. It's certainly not the same rates that it is for harder drugs. But, and I think we could probably find common ground on this, Ethan, that if you start post 18, so if you start smoking weed, I wish everybody would wait till they were 24. If you haven't started smoking weed yet, wait till you're 24. You should be just fine. There shouldn't be an issue with you. But if you start after 18, your odds of developing a clinically diagnosable addiction, so it would meet the criteria set forth in the DSM manual, would be about a 1 in 11. If you start pre-18, your odds of developing a clinically diagnosable addiction to the drug would be about a 1 in 6. So this isn't my opinion, it's not theory, this is the American Society of Addiction Medicine, the American Medical Association, the smart guys at the table. So it's important to recognize that, and hopefully respect that, while I'm coming here and saying, I get that the majority of people who use and smoke and try and experiment will never have an issue with it, it's really important to recognize too that even if this hasn't been your experience, a lot of people who do, that either 1 in 6 or 1 in 11, do end up having an issue with it. And that's my entire sample group, and that sample group is growing back home.
So let me just ask you this one quick question then. So I understand what you're saying, and I understand Sam's position on legalization. You said that you don't want to put people in jail for using or possessing small amounts of marijuana. Is Sam in favor of decriminalizing marijuana and coming up with a way to treat people who are who violate marijuana laws, treating them as having a medical concern or medical issue?
Sam advocates for interventions. So those brief interventions would, of course, be cumulative in nature. They would probably start off with something that was about, nothing. So you get caught the first time, and maybe it's a 30-minute thing. Maybe it's a conversation with somebody. You get caught the second time, it's probably more of a structured education. And then what happens after that? And I'm sorry, you guys. I'm not trying to duck this at all, Jason. Mm-hmm. We might want to ask Kevin about that at Sam, or look on the website.
Okay, thanks. Taylor, do you want to?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Ben, hearing you describe Sam's position, and then thinking back to what I heard Patrick Kennedy, who founded your organization, and Kevin Sabet unveil a few weeks ago. And what they talked about was a very different system. And you're describing treatment, but what you're not mentioning is that you're talking about forced treatment at the point of a gun, essentially.
Absolutely not.
What Sam articulated through their principles a few weeks ago was that what they want to see is if you get caught with marijuana, you're forced into treatment. And if you don't follow through that with that treatment, then you're forced into jail. And again, maybe your position is different than what we heard from the organization's leadership recently. But that was clearly articulated by Kevin Sabet and Patrick Kennedy. This isn't a voluntary thing. And under a system where marijuana was taxed and regulated like alcohol, people would have every right to send themselves to a treatment facility. And we'd see that happen. We know that marijuana as an intoxicating substance has some potential for abuse, as does nicotine and alcohol and fatty foods. We've seen, New York City say that, drinking too much soda is bad for you. It causes you to be fat, heart attacks, all these things. So we're not going to let you do that. And that doesn't fly in Alaska. This idea that the government is going to regulate otherwise safe behavior because there's some 1 in 11 chance that it could be abused. And I think what's important to recognize is that the cases where it is abused are not all that bad. And it's nowhere near the severity of alcohol, for example.
Absolutely not the case.
And so we those of us who live here understand the impact that alcohol has on this state. It's ruining communities throughout the state. And to suggest that alcohol, which is legal, and which when it's abused, kills people, causes domestic violence, rape, murder, car crashes, all of these terrible things, that this substance should be legal. And we're looking at marijuana, which has, in your own words, a 1 in 12 chance of being abused. And we know from every medical study, from public opinion polls that have shown 75% of Americans believe marijuana is safer than alcohol, that in the cases that marijuana is abused, we're not seeing those devastating impacts. And so, this idea, it's just, and I think it underscores why the support amongst the public is where it is.
Taylor, I want to interrupt for a minute. I want to ask, kick this over to Dean for a second, because as the other Alaskan on the panel who's been working on these issues for a long time, and now as a no longer currently working for the Department of Law, maybe Dean can talk a little bit more about his personal perspective on this. I'm just wondering if in your experience, in your career, seeing drug and alcohol crimes and the extent of them in Alaska, if you have any thoughts on shifting Alaska's criminal penalties for drug and alcohol crimes to more of a treatment model.
Well, I'm gonna defer to Ben to some extent. If forced treatment often does not work, and repeated forced treatment often does not work. When you're talking about a true marijuana dependency, there are very few treatments that work effectively. I will agree with everyone who says that alcohol is the number one problem in Alaska from a criminal justice perspective. But we're taxing and regulating that industry, and that means we're doing a terrible job at it. Nationwide, it's estimated that the amount of tax on alcohol pays for maybe a tenth of the problems it causes. And where does the rest fall? It falls on on state and local agencies from a criminal justice perspective and from a health perspective, who knows, private industry and maybe now the federal government. You know, we haven't done a good job in regulating that industry. Why would we want to, or the tobacco industry for that matter? And part of the reason is that those industries, they're big businesses. They've got shareholders that they have to answer to. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising to get, you know, a new generation of customers. And they've got lobbyists, and they've got lobbyists working every state legislature and Congress. I mean, our country has been giving hundreds of millions of dollars in tobacco subsidies, for God's sakes. So to say that we ought to regulate a psychoactive substance like marijuana in the same way as these other substances doesn't make any sense to me. Why would we want to have a third industry growing up like that? I would favor doubling the alcohol tax in Alaska. I would favor making it much more difficult for alcohol to get into rural villages. I've got some ideas along those lines. If you really want to make some impacts in Alaska, and particularly in rural Alaska, alcohol is where we need to put our effort. We've been doing it for a long time. There's more that can be done. Marijuana is simply not a criminal justice problem in Alaska. We don't have mandatory sentencing for marijuana like they do in, you know, for some other drug offenses down south, particularly in the federal system. You know, I've looked at marijuana cases, you know, particularly misdemeanor possession cases that go through the courts. You see suspended sentence, suspended sentence, suspended sentence. Nothing is happening to people. Every once in a while, though, you'll see somebody does some jail time, and it's because a felony case was plea bargained down to a misdemeanor, and so it looks on paper like a misdemeanor marijuana case, or the person had a long criminal record, or the person was doing other things. Marijuana cases in Alaska are simply not a problem that needs to be addressed. Alcohol needs to be addressed, and I'd support just about anything that we can do to make inroads there.
Thank you. Lance, we haven't heard from you in a while. So I have found a quote in preparing for tonight. I found a quote from you where you said, "The war on drugs has made many people lose faith in the integrity of government." Can you explain to us a little bit about what you mean by that?
Sure. When you have programs where you have officers going into the school systems and talking about drugs in an area where they're not necessarily experts, and they're describing things to youngsters, and then time passes, and the kids get out of these programs, and they come up to me years later and say, "Hey, thanks for that program you had in our school back in, I don't want to show my age here, but let's just say maybe the 80s. You know, thanks a lot. Everything I learned about drugs, I learned from the program that you did in our school." And what happens is when they say one thing in the school program, and then the kids get out of school, they get to be older, get to be adults, and they find out that everything they learned in that drug program was a lie. Everything was wrong. You know, especially about things like marijuana, that it was the plant with its roots in hell. You know, some of that nonsense just doesn't fly. And what happens is they look at this and go, "Well, they lied to us about marijuana. What else are they lying about?" And that's where I question the impact that it has on the integrity of government. That's why I asked that question. And you need to understand, I also come at this problem from another perspective, and that's because I'm a fifth-generation farmer. And when we get all done here and everybody leaves tonight, and you talk about this issue, and you've got a lot of decisions to make in Alaska, I would ask you to remember one thing. It's just a plant.
You know, well, Lance, you know, that answer is interesting because you voice a certain, you know, distrust in the way that drug laws have been implemented. And we just received a question that I think kind of flows sort of nicely from that. And I'll address this to Ethan. And that question is, what is the hurry to legalize? Shouldn't we wait to see how this works out in other states first?
the longer you wait, the longer you persist with the harms and hypocrisies of marijuana prohibition. There's no reason to wait, right? The people in Alaska and around the country now want it to happen. In fact, you know, I'll tell you something. If you ask the deeper question, like, what am I actually fighting for on this whole marijuana thing? It's that a generation from now, and hopefully sooner, people will look back on the marijuana wars and marijuana prohibition of today the same way that today we look back on alcohol prohibition and basically go, what the hell was that all about? Right? I mean, that is, we're fighting for the day so that our children and grandchildren can grow up and just think that, yeah, marijuana is a psychoactive substance, right? It's not as dangerous as alcohol and cigarettes, but it's problems, and you shouldn't start using it when you're young, and it's a problem. Don't go to work high and don't drive, but basically, you guys made a criminal? You actually arrested millions of people for this? You deprived people of access to jobs? You told anybody who ever smoked a joint they couldn't get a job in the military or law enforcement or this or that, they couldn't get licenses? You took people's kids away from them because they smoked marijuana? You know, you put this whole thing, they're going to think, well, people must have been crazy back in the late 20th century, you know? And I'll tell you something else. For those of you here who are Alaskans, you're not just Alaskans, you're Americans. You're part of a national wave and a national transformation of treating marijuana as a criminal market to treating it as a legal market, right? Washington and Colorado stepped out. They stepped out in a big way, and they're doing it right. The only news out of Colorado since they actually set up stores 2 months ago, it's too soon to evaluate anything, really. There's only one piece of news out of Colorado since they opened the first marijuana stores 10 weeks ago, or 9 weeks ago. And you know what that is? That the state government was surprised that tax revenue from legal marijuana sales was twice as high as they expected. That's the only substantive news out of Colorado since they opened those stores. But the fact of the matter, it's important for you to do this in August. It's important for Oregon to do it in November. And it's going to be important for a whole bunch of other states to do it in 2016 because we have to sustain the momentum. Alaska plays a role. This is not just about what Alaska does for Alaskans. This is about sending a message to the rest of the country. It's about providing leadership, and it's about making sure that those people want to roll this thing back and keep marijuana illegal, keep it underground, keep the cops arresting tons of people, right? That's the stuff we have to prevent. That's the role I think you all have to play.
Interesting. So, Ben, Ethan just mentioned the surprising tax numbers, I suppose, that have come out of Colorado. And we have a question that asks about whether the economic and social costs of drug use are outweighed, or do the social and economic costs of drug use outweigh the benefits that taxes confer? And maybe you can also explain where the tax money in Colorado is going and how that plan works.
Yes, the answer is yes, they outweigh it. And I'm going to tell you that. But the longer you wait, the more you learn, guys. And what we just heard, what I just heard, was the importance of Alaska inside of a national strategy, inside of a national movement to move legalization to this different place inside of America, not about Alaska. I'm not hearing the state-specific stuff. I'm not hearing the concern for what's going on. And again, I can tell you what's happening. You're not looking at little numbers that don't matter. You're 2 days after legalization, 2 miles up the road from me, a two-year-old girl ate a cookie and ended up in the ER because you got to cut them into fourths because they're so toxic. We have THC-infused beverages that have four to a serving because they're so potent. Our butane-extracted hash that's produced on this massive industrial scale is 80 to 90% THC. You hot knife it. Anybody else know what else you hot knife? You guys, in this, my man, and this was something that was allowed for because of the permissive language inside of our legislation. Let's keep this specific to your legislation. This is something specifically protected inside of your state, inside of this legislation. The right for these folks to manufacture on a mass scale this butane extracted hash. It's 80 to 90% THC. Man, come on. Now, tax revenues. Yes, It's actually about $138 million that the governor speculates will make over the next 18 months. It's an interesting thing because we have a year's worth of data in an all-cash business. Who's exactly sure what that really means? But let's work with his dollar figure. We were mandated by Amendment 64, actually a vote after Amendment 64, because Tabor, which is a taxpayer bill of rights in Colorado, doesn't allow you to mandate anything specifically to one place without another popular vote. So the first $40 million of our tax revenue had to go to new school construction, even though the Education Association, the Teachers Union, each came out publicly opposed to Amendment 64 and said, we don't want that money. It sends the wrong message to our kids. Well, whatever. They got the money, so they can do what they want to with that $40 million when it comes in. The rest of this money is being spent to clean up the problem. $45.5 million is going to a marketing campaign. You guys know much about Colorado at all. You know there's very few media markets there, really only three. We got down south, we're focused on family rules, everything. We got the Denver market, you got the Western Slope, more or less. We have three media markets. We're going to spend $45 million, according to the governor's bill, to address youth use. That's not little money, that's not a joke. He's taken this $128 million windfall that we've got, that, by the way, last week he told all the other governors at their annual meeting, don't go down this road. It's foolish and this money's not really going anywhere. We're spending it all to clean up the mess. $45 million going to the youth prevention campaign. Another $40 million going to treatment. Those of us in treatment in Colorado are banding together to sign up to say, keep your money. We don't want it. The fact that you're giving us this penance because we're going to have to clean up the mess that y'all have made, we're not into that. This, the idea that we are going to get this massive windfall, but by the time you do all the math, you take the $40 million, there's about $2 million left that's going to go into the general fund. So the best analogy I heard from this was that this is, yes, there's going to be money coming in, but it's the same thing as stepping in front of a bus so that you can get your insurance money to pay for your medical bills on the back end of it. We wouldn't need that money if we didn't have it really comes down to the youth use. Again, I don't care if you get high if you're older than that. It's the youth use. We wouldn't need it if that wasn't just through the roof. And as I continue to hear, we don't have the data, we don't have the number. Oh, we do, and I'll give it to you. And you can ask more questions. I'm rambling now, but I've got it.
Well, you know, while we're talking about taxes and cost savings and the money involved, I'm wondering if any of the panelists has some insight into what are the criminal justice cost savings with reducing prosecutions and enforcement, and how much money and time and manpower is being spent on that. Maybe Taylor and then Dean could potentially respond to that.
Yeah, Jason, I'm actually going to take just a second to respond to something that Mr. Court just said. This isn't about a national movement, Ben. The idea that Alaskans don't support this is an insult to the 46,000 people who signed the petition to get this on the ballot. It's an insult to the 55% to 60% of Alaskans who currently support the initiative. And so I think it's unfair, quite frankly, for you to come into this state and tell us that this is something we don't want, because you're wrong. That's number one. Number two, this idea that because you have a governor who thinks that government is the answer to everything and is spending money that doesn't need to be spent, that doesn't mean it's going to happen here, okay? Your governor has decided that to take the tax revenue that the state received and to pour all that money into government. You're not going to see the same thing in Alaska. The state put together a projection, which quite frankly we believe is high, and they're talking about spending maybe $3 to $5 million on implementation. We know without question that the initiative will bring in more tax revenue than that. We also know that it's not all about the tax revenue, and the economic benefit of any program can't be measured entirely by the money that's going into the state coffers in Juneau. We're talking about jobs that are currently being held by criminals, money that's currently benefiting criminal organizations that's going to be brought above ground. Jobs are going to be created for people that pay taxes. The product is going to be sold by tax-paying businesses. And so the whole, you know, this idea that tax revenue is the main thing, that might be important in Colorado, but I can guarantee you that Alaskans don't see it that way.
So Taylor, what about the criminal justice savings? Do you guys have any information or positions on that?
We know that there will be savings. The state is currently, my understanding, is working on updating their projections, and I think we expect to see something this summer. But we know that, you know, law enforcement is currently spending money going after marijuana growers, et cetera, and clearly once this initiative is passed and those operations are moved above ground, you're not going to have these big government programs to go after marijuana users.
Dean, do you have any thoughts on the criminal justice costs of, I guess, keeping marijuana illegal or legalization?
As I said before, the marijuana laws are not a problem in Alaska. The law enforcement has a lot of priorities. They do a lot of things in Alaska, and marijuana possession cases is not high on the priority list. If they do a traffic stop and you roll down your window marijuana smoke pours out, they've got to do something. But they aren't going after those kinds of cases. I was talking to somebody from the state troopers, and there was recently a federal grant that went to the state troopers, and they sent it out to some municipalities to deal with marijuana growing. They had to give back some of that money because many of the municipalities are focused on other kinds of drugs. Marijuana enforcement is not a big priority in Alaska unless you are growing it in commercial quantities. Basically, you are pushing an illegal product. Now, if anyone thinks that all of those marijuana growers are going to all of a sudden become legal and get licensed and start paying taxes and sell only to regulated retail establishments, I think you're mistaken. That's not the way it works. Ethan talked about Mexican drug gangs and drug lords and why are we giving billions of dollars to them? Those organizations are going to exist regardless of what we do here in Alaska. A small part of those organizations is marijuana. It simply is not an issue in Alaska that needs to be addressed. But no one's asked me about the effect on kids.
I'm going to come to that in just a second.
Okay, good.
Let me ask you this, though. So if marijuana enforcement is not that big of a deal in Alaska, if we don't have such a huge problem with it, what's wrong with legalizing it?
Because when something is a crime, it acts as a deterrent to people using it. There are studies. Look, come on. I knew what kind of audience I was gonna get here. People said they're gonna boo you. They're gonna laugh at you. That's okay. There are studies that show that when your parents disapprove of marijuana, you're much less likely to use it as a kid. When there are criminal penalties in existence, you're much less likely to use it. And so the penalties, the crimes are the legislature's judgment that this isn't something that we want going to our kids, that we want a higher percentage of our kids to use, and it acts as a deterrent. Go ahead and laugh.
Well, Dean, why don't we use that as a segue? We're starting to hit the point where we're down to about 15 or 20 minutes left. So what I want to do is spend a few minutes talking about marijuana and kids, and we'll let you get that issue started if you want to make a couple of more points about that. And then we have a stack of questions that are Alaska-specific and about the contours of the potential Alaska initiative, and we'll get into that after we talk a little bit about kids.
In 2006, the Alaska legislature held hearings on marijuana. The main proponents for supporting marijuana were the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and Jason was working for them as their counsel at the time. They brought in a couple of experts, marijuana experts from down south, college professors, and presented to the Alaska legislatures a lot of information. There were hearings in a lot of different committees. These professors had written books. And one of the things they said was, there is an effect on fetal development with pregnant women who use marijuana. Now, I heard Ethan say there's nothing like FAS or FAE, fetal alcohol syndrome, regarding marijuana use. Well, these experts who the ACLU brought in front of the Alaska legislature. They said the opposite. That was in 2006. What they also said at the time was, what we know about adolescent brain development is that the brains keep developing through adolescence and some of the higher brain functions, such as reasoning, memory, judgment, develop into your late 20s and or late teens and early 20s, and that's why Ben is saying if you're over 24 and you start using marijuana, you know, that's not as much of a problem. But at that time in 2006, what these experts told the legislature was, we don't want kids using it. Kids shouldn't be using it. That was in 2006. Now, recently, that's been quantified. There's been a study that tracked children, measured their IQ from the time they were children into their 30s. And what they found was that those kids who started using marijuana in their early teens, used it on a regular basis, there was a measurable drop in their IQs. It was measurable, and it continued to some extent into their 30s. And the amount of IQ drop, the earlier you started using marijuana, and the more regularly you used it, and I think it was several times a week, it amounted to 8 IQ points. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but let's take the average IQ of 100 in the 50th percentile. You drop 8 IQ points, and you've dropped from the 50th percentile to the 29th percentile. That's the kind of measurable information that we've got now. Back in 2006, the experts were saying, we don't want kids using it. Now it's measurable. What they say is that marijuana changes the proportion between the white brain cells and the gray brain cells, and I don't know a lot about that. All I did know is I listen to what the experts say, and there is a definite measurable impact. There is a reason why a coalition of Northwest Indian tribes, voted to oppose legalization of marijuana in the Northwest. And part of that is that in rural Alaska, and with Alaska Native students, they use marijuana at a much higher rate than other students in the state. I mean, this is a real Alaska problem. It's a real problem in the bush. It's a real problem for Alaska Natives. On every measurement, use in the last 30 days, whether you've ever used marijuana, and the most frightening one, how many used marijuana for the first time before the age of 13? The Alaska Natives scored on that particular one, double the rate of non-natives. Now, that is a real significant problem here in Alaska. It's a problem maybe unique to our state. It's why the Native organizations are opposed to marijuana. And frankly, it's one of the big failings of this proposed initiative, because even though Alaska state law allows villages to make possession of alcohol illegal, I mean, villages can vote to go damp under our local option laws for alcohol. They can't under this initiative with respect to marijuana. They can prohibit marijuana retailers from coming into their village, but with respect to marijuana itself, people can go outside of the village, buy marijuana, bring it back in, transfer it to somebody else. It's perfectly legal under this initiative. This initiative badly fails the Alaska Native population. It's an Alaska-specific problem, and it's a road we shouldn't go down.
Ethan, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I just need to respond. First of all, Dean, what you're describing about the problems among marijuana use and other drug use, but especially marijuana use among Alaskan natives and young people using, everything you're describing is happening while marijuana is still illegal. I mean, so the notion that legalization is the problem when you have this terrible problem under prohibition, it seems to me is a devastating indictment of prohibition. At the very least, prohibition has failed to protect that population, and who knows if, in fact, it's exacerbating it. The second thing I'll say is it's very interesting. When you look in those parts of the world where people are too poor to even afford to buy a joint or a hit off a crack pipe or whatever it might be, you know, poor Aboriginal people, poor whatever it might be, what do? Are they drug-free? No. They're sniffing glue and gasoline and things like that. What's the most devastating thing you can do to the youthful brain or the adult brain in terms of psychoactive substances? It's glue and gasoline and huffing and all this sort of stuff. Now, let me ask you, what's the criminal justice response to huffing and glue and gasoline? There isn't one. There can't be one. How do you make a criminal justice response? But what it does is it points out the futility and absurdity of thinking that you can use the criminal law, the criminal justice system, prosecutors and police to protect vulnerable young people in our society. I'll tell you something else. You know this IQ study that Dean mentioned? It came out of New Zealand a couple of years ago. You know what it actually found? It found that for people who started smoking marijuana at a very young age and continued to do so in a heavy way, and then continued on to be heavy marijuana users into adulthood, they found the reduction in IQ. It also suggested that if you were a heavy user of marijuana as an adolescent but stopped as an adult, or conversely, if you didn't use marijuana as an adolescent but were a heavy user as an adult, there was no reduction in the IQ. Then it turned out, subsequent studies came out and were not able to replicate the results of that IQ study, and all sorts of questions were raised about the methodology of it. So do we all agree that young people should not use marijuana? Yes. Do we all agree that it's good to delay the onset of marijuana use? Yes. Do we all agree that if you have mental illness, underlying mental illness, that marijuana for some people would help, but for many people it'll hurt? Yes. But in the end, is that ultimately an argument that says that we need to be arresting hundreds of thousands of people for marijuana and keeping this as an underground market and promoting the hypocrisy of DARE programs and all the other stuff in our society? No, it's not an argument for sustaining the current policy. It's an argument for getting real and pragmatic about how we deal with marijuana in our society.
Well, speaking of some real and pragmatic things, we are starting to run out of time, and I want to address a few questions that some people have submitted. And I think this is a real pragmatic problem that people who are medical marijuana users run into. And this question asks, will legitimate medicinal marijuana patients' insurance cover their medicine? And I guess this is more of a speculative question. And I'd say if anyone on the panel wants to offer a guess as to whether we will ever see insurance companies covering medicinal marijuana?
Well, I think my short answer to that is that it's never going to happen if prohibition continues. And so there's nothing in the law that's being proposed that addresses that directly. But clearly, passing the law would make it easier for that to happen.
Speaking of health concerns and legalization. This question says, I use cannabis to ease my mental health symptoms. I'm also a preschool teacher. If marijuana is legalized, what protections will be in place for people who are in the workforce? And Ben, as someone who deals with mental health and addiction issues in Colorado, and as someone from a state where marijuana has been legalized, do you know if this is a problem? What is Colorado doing to address the concerns of people who want to legally use marijuana, but their jobs may prohibit it?
Well, it's interesting. There's a federal statute and the right to work statute that the federal government keeps, and they kind of trump everything else, that says that an employer can't preclude an employee from doing anything legal outside of work hours. So your best example there would be a pastor who wants to go to the strip club during the week and then comes back. Technically, he can't be punished for that sort of thing. So consumption of, if this were legal under state law, consumption outside of work hours would be something that under federal law, the employee would probably have some protection with. However, there's also the Drug-Free Workplace Act, which says that anytime you pop dirty for anything, an employer can let you go. And that's not going to change. So you've got two federal policies that are kind of have horns locked on that. And there is absolutely not a clean answer to that question. That's that is a litigious question. And I try and shy away from those.
Well, I'm kicking all the litigious questions to Dean tonight. So Dean, let me ask you this. We have a question that asks about preemption. It says, how would federal preemption affect Alaska state law if marijuana is legalized in Alaska? And earlier tonight I mentioned that the Department of Justice response has said that we're going to allow this experiment to continue in Washington and Colorado where it has been legalized. And the assumption is that if marijuana is legalized in Alaska and that policy is still in place, that we would fall under the guidance of that decision. So I guess this is a two-part question, and one is if you know perhaps you could speak to the issue of preemption, and you know what concerns we have to worry about if marijuana is legalized in Alaska, and as a matter as a policy issue, do we have to be worried that if marijuana is legalized and people take advantage of changes in the law, that a change in federal administration can then have drastic consequences for legal users in Alaska?
It's been the case for many years that the Justice Department here in Alaska, the U.S. Attorney's Office, has essentially refused to get involved in marijuana cases unless they reached a certain weight threshold, and it used to be 50 pounds or 50 kilos or something. I mean, it was an awful high amount. And I don't see any indication that is going to change. In other words, that the federal law enforcement perspective here in Alaska is going to change any policies that it's been operating under recently. I think that at the federal level, a change in administration is going to revisit this question, and I think it remains to be seen. I mean, if Ethan and Taylor are right and there are no unintended consequences and everything's just coming up roses in all the states that have legalized marijuana, I don't think the feds are going to interfere even under a change in administration. But if I'm right and if Ben is right about some of the effects that have already started to be being seen in Colorado, and that what I anticipate, and that there really are significant effects, then I think a new administration is going to have some different facts to consider.
Thank you. Here's an interesting question. This person asks, this is the third debate I've been to on this subject. Where are the elected lawmakers? I never see elected lawmakers here at these debates. This is the first such debate that I've ever put together, so I can tell you why we don't have anyone on this panel. But I'm curious to hear from the panelists if there are elected officials out there, either nationally or in Alaska, who are in favor of and who support legalization. Or is this just too, you know, it's the third rail of politics and they don't like to touch it? Lance?
My name is Lance, and I'm a recovering politician. I can tell you, as sheriff, when I get out and just talk to the local groups, and of course it's on a much smaller scale. This would be about what I'd see at the usual budget meeting when people tell me I couldn't have toilet paper for the jail. You would have debates on this right out in the open, and overwhelmingly, my constituents would tell me to not waste time on marijuana. They simply wanted it taxed and regulated. That's all I can say as someone who's actually been an elected official. Of course, I'm retired now and enjoying it. Thank you very much.
If it's anything like back home, they'll get involved a little bit closer to the action. I mean, everybody kind of punted and waited to see. And, you know, as politicians, they want to watch polls and everything. But, yeah, my guess is if it's anything like back home, they'll weigh in because everybody back home weighed in, but they waited until the election was a lot closer. That's just a guess.
Okay. But it is notable. I mean, here you have polls across the country showing 55% plus support for legalizing marijuana and barely 40% opposition, but not one member of the U.S. Senate has clearly come out in favor. Some are tiptoeing in that direction. In the House of Representatives, maybe there are 18 to 20. Among governors, you don't really have a single governor, although the governor of Oregon recently said that he thinks it's inevitable. Among lieutenant governors, there's now one, California, Gavin Newsom. Among state legislators, it's beginning to change. So I think this is very much an issue on which the people lead and the politicians follow. And the closer they are to Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill, the longer it'll take for them to get there. You know, Alaska is one of the 24 or 25 states where you have the ballot initiative process, and that means you are in a position to lead. I live in New York. We do not have a ballot initiative process. Right now, we don't even have legal medical marijuana. We have overwhelming support in the assembly. We have a majority of the votes in the state senate. We finally got the governor agreed, but the head of the state senate refuses to put it to a vote. So even when you have overwhelming majority support, the legislators find it really hard to move on this issue. And I think when it comes to the marijuana issue, many of them are still scared of their own shadow on this issue. In fact, they're not quite to the point of understanding that for many people running for office, this issue can work for them. And I'll just finish by saying the most inspiring case I saw was down in El Paso, Texas. There was a young member of the city council, Beto O'Rourke, who, you know, introduced a resolution calling on Congress to look at legalization. And he got shot down by his local congressman. And then he left the city council, wrote a book about why we should legalize marijuana. And then he announced he was going to run for Congress, right? And he ran in the Democratic primary in a heavily Democratic district, but a conservative Democratic district, El Paso, Texas, against the incumbent, who was a former Border Patrol officer, a longtime Democratic congressman. And Beto O'Rourke, the young pro-marijuana legalization congressman, beat him and is now a member of Congress. So things are beginning to change.
Well, this was this question, actually, this is the only question that someone actually put their name on. So Lee, good question. And I'll tell you that for purposes of this panel, the reason we don't have any elected lawmakers here is that we had five amazing speakers who were willing to come, and we didn't feel that we needed to invite any politicians to that. So thank you all for coming. We are about out of time. So what I'd like to do, though, is just to wrap things up, to give each panelist one final question and give you each about a minute to respond to it. And I think what I will do is I will start with Taylor, and we will ask you this question, which is, Alaska has tried to legalize in the past, and it has failed. Why will it succeed this time?
Because the public opinion has changed really rapidly. The efforts you saw 10 years ago were not supported by a majority of Alaskans. They are now. The law that we're talking about now is a lot more reasonable than the efforts that have gone forward in the past. Previously, you had amnesty as a part of the bills. You had a lot more wide open legalization structures. What we're talking about doing this time is legalizing marijuana like alcohol in the state. And the polls are in our favor. And the world really has changed on this issue, and it's certainly changed in Alaska. Since this is the last question, I need to mention a couple things. The first is we do have a website. It's www.regulatemarijuanainalaska.com. Chris Rempert is the political director for the campaign and has a booth set up outside the event, so I'd encourage you all to go grab some materials, register to vote if you aren't already. Final point, the polling shows that this is an issue, it's really a generational divide. 72% of Alaskans ages 18 to 29 support this issue, with only 20% opposing it. And so you really have an opportunity in this election to make a difference. And if you all register to vote, get your friends to register to vote, go out and vote, you can have a major impact. You can help this initiative pass. And I think we'll all be sort of sticking around afterwards. So if you have any questions, you can come find me or, like I said, Chris Rempert in the back.
Lance, you've got 60 seconds. What message do you want to give to any law enforcement officials who are out there who are on the fence about legalization?
Go to our website, check out the information, leap.cc. Join us, join the effort, join the people who know exactly what we need to do here. Good luck, Alaska. Godspeed with this. I would like you to remember one thing. Think about human history, archaeology. What has it taught us about this? We have had a relationship with this plant for thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. The prohibition is what is atypical of our relationship with this plant. Okay? And it will go down in history as being an aberration, all right? It's just a plant. God causes the grasses to grow for cattle and the herbs in the service of man.
Thank you.
So, Dean, you were obviously involved, I imagine, in reviewing the previous attempts to legalize marijuana, whether formally as part of your job or as an individual. So you're familiar with the previous attempts to legalize. This bill is a little, or this initiative is a little bit different than the others. But as your summation, can you tell us what is, you know, what are the one or two things that you are most concerned about with this initiative? And from what I'm hearing from you today, you're encouraging people, or for yourself personally, you would vote against it. What are the one or two things that you think are most troubling about this particular initiative?
Sure. There have been attempts to legalize before. They've failed in Alaska. I think what's different is that Washington and Colorado did it. And as Ben Cort says, let's wait and see what happens in those states. I will agree that we're never going to completely eradicate drugs, as Ethan Nadelman says. They're going to be drugs whether we like it or not. But does that mean that we have to have ever stronger drugs, like Ben Cort was saying? Does it mean we have to have marijuana that's flavored to appeal to kids? Does it mean that we have to have designer marijuana? Those kinds of things are happening in Colorado, and they're real. I think where Ethan Nadelman and I really differ is that he believes that with legalization, there's not going to be any increase in use. And I believe just the opposite. It's happened in other places. He and I can arm wrestle about that afterwards. But it's going to happen in Colorado. It's going to happen in Washington. I hope it doesn't happen in Alaska, because I hope this ballot measure goes down to defeat.
So, Ethan, you obviously have had the most stage time tonight, and you've talked quite a bit about a number of different aspects of marijuana legalization. As a close, can you just tell us what is the absolute core of this issue, especially for Alaska? I know, right? The lesson tonight, try to get Ethan Nadelman to say something in less than 60 seconds.
I can't speak for Alaska on this. I can speak for myself. And the core is about personal freedom. That's the core.
We got Ethan to respond in less than 30 seconds. Great. Ben, we'll give you the last word on the panel tonight. What is the main takeaway that you want people to leave here with tonight as they consider not just this particular ballot initiative? Because if it succeeds, we're going to go in one direction. If it fails, it's certainly an issue that will pop up again. It's something we're looking at in other states. So what do you want people to know and to take away from this discussion tonight about legalization in Alaska and then legalization more broadly?
Let's just consider this initiative right now. I'll make a comment quickly, I guess broadly if I can. But what this looks like at home, and again, this proposed legislation is even more permissive than what ours is. What this looks like at home is full color ads in the Denver Post with cartoon characters selling weed. It's billboards, it's on buses, it's on taxis, it's cartoon, I've got my phone's just full of it. It's Fred Flintstone with two chicks in bikinis next to him selling it. It's 20% off with student IDs. It's aggressive marketing of something that, I would have so much harder of a time taking this stance if I could sit with Lance on this one, that it is God's herb. I got no issue with God's herb. Yes, George Washington probably smoked at what, 0.2% THC, we're all guessing. What you've got when it gets industrialized the way that it has at home and the way that it is planning on being industrialized here is a THC content of 20 to 30% in its smoke form and concentrates that are 80 to 90%. Nobody's got a problem with you growing a little bit of weed and smoking it. What we've got a problem with at home is the industry that has sprung up around this and the aggressive marketing that they need to sustain that industry. I came from business. What you got to do to not grow is to die, they say in business. So you got to get new users and you got to get more frequent users. careful with this one. Read the language and know what you're voting for on this one, guys.
Thank you. Well, you know, at the beginning of the evening, I mentioned that marijuana legalization touches on a broad array of topics. There are criminal justice concerns, there are legal concerns, there are mental health matters, there are issues with juveniles, there are economic considerations, and then there are the matters of personal freedom and autonomy and federalism and states' rights. This is an issue that is very complicated, and we really just scratched the surface here tonight. And I want to actually apologize to the panelists that we could not give more time for everyone to explain in further detail these issues. We could have very easily had a series of these events touching on every one of those topics that I just mentioned. Unfortunately, the constraints of time and funding prohibited us from doing that. I worked for a while on these issues, and now I do research and study marijuana legalization matters both here and nationally, and listening to these experts talk tonight, I learned several things. This is not an easy subject to wrap your minds around. A lot of people came in here tonight with your minds made up one way or the other. Some of you were in the middle. I encourage all of you to really dig into this issue. As Ben said, it is not necessarily a black and white issue. There are a lot of shades of green, maybe? Thanks. Not to joke too much about it, but this is a really serious issue, and I think Project Sam has some materials out there. LEAP has some materials. The campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol in Alaska has some issues. You can go to the websites for any of these speakers and learn a lot more about this issue. It's complicated, it's rich, it's interesting, and it is something that we are dealing with right now, not just nationally, but in our state. So I want to thank you all for coming tonight. I want to thank our panelists for being here. And I guess that's it. People might stick around to answer some more questions.
Thanks. Thank you, guys.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans. Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, Ethan Nadelman. Taylor Bickford with the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol in Alaska. Lance Buchholz of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Ben Court of Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And former Chief Assistant Attorney General for Alaska, Dean Guinelli. Moderated by Jason Brandeis of the UAA Justice Center, titled Time to Legalize, a Public Discussion on Marijuana Law and Policy, was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on March 5th and shortened for broadcast on KSKA. Listen to a recording of the discussion in its entirety on our website, alaskapublic.org. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Beattie Trantina. Thank you for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.